You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is The Slate. The inference traced a rate cut timed for December, waiting on a supply-side finding the new task forces were to certify by year-end. On July 9th, the Federal Reserve named the people who will certify it. Read against what each has spent a decade concluding, the roster is the finding. Kevin Warsh arrived at the Federal Reserve chairmanship in May 2026, carrying a doctrine he had spent 15 years assembling. Its root is a diagnosis. American inflation is not an act of pandemics, oil markets, or foreign wars. It is a choice the central bank itself makes, because the central bank can hit any price level that it wants, and the institution making that choice has swollen beyond its constitution, behaving, as he put it at the IMF in April 2025, more as a general-purpose agency of government than a narrow central bank. On July 9th, shortly after 3 p.m., the Fed announced the instrument through which that doctrine is to become institutional fact. Five task forces, co-led by 15 outside experts, charged with examining the central bank's methods and reporting by the end of the year. As Kevin Warsh put it, the Federal Reserve's commitment to price stability and maximum employment is unwavering. The U.S. economy has changed significantly over the last generation. Each task force will carefully consider whether policymakers' means and methods can be improved upon. The release promises that the panels will operate independently with a mandate to follow the evidence. Whether they will find anything is another question, because the 15 arrive with published records on precisely the matters they are asked to reopen. These are testable claims, and the test must begin where the announcement did not, with the doctrine itself. Five planks. The doctrine is not one belief, but five, each documented in Warsh's own words across the decade. First, humility over false precision. A central bank should stop publishing what it cannot know. In practice, retire forward guidance, the Fed's public promises about the future path of interest rates, and the point paths of the dot plot, its quarterly grid of anonymous rate projections. Replace point forecasts with scenario ranges, above all for anything as uncertain as artificial intelligence. Demote the Phillips curve and NAIRU, the models that read future inflation off today's unemployment, from operational guides to background, and size the balance sheet off market signals rather than fixed targets. The conviction is documented at both ends of his career. His 2014 review of the Bank of England argued that too much transparency degrades judgment. Creating a safe space for true deliberations is among the most critical indicia of organizations that make good decisions. And at his first meeting as chairman, he refused to file his own rate projection, calling it not helpful in the conduct of policy. Second, a smaller, less activist footprint. A leaner portfolio of treasuries only, the mortgage bonds, mortgage-backed securities, MBS in the trade's shorthand, run off. Bond buying, known as quantitative easing or QE, reclassified as emergency medicine rather than a standing tool. A light footprint even in data, partnering with private sources rather than building an estate of its own. In short, a Fed that stays in its lane. He resigned from the Board of Governors in 2011 rather than support a second round of bond buying, has said the institution treated every day for more than a decade like it's a crisis, and called the result, in a 2024 opinion piece, a bloated balance sheet. Third, credibility and independence as the paramount assets. The policy statement, not speeches, not leaks, carries the signal. Members stand accountable for their own votes. The 2% inflation target is held symmetrically and credibly, misses above treated like misses below, and the Fed defends itself explicitly against fiscal dominance, the pressure to keep rates low because the government's debts are expensive. The premise is the diagnosis in his own words. If the central bank can hit any price level that it wants, responsibility cannot be outsourced, and independence has to be earned by delivering on the promises. Fourth, rules-leaning but not mechanical. A clear reaction function and credible commitment, the opposite of the full discretion of a central banker's latest whims, yet short of a hard formula, a Taylor rule that sets the interest rate by arithmetic, or a target for total nominal spending, NGDP, and the Fed's 2% number itself ring-fenced from the review. I tend to focus on the left of the decimal point. Fifth, a supply-side disinflationary worldview. Productivity, today artificial intelligence, raises the economy's potential output and its neutral rate, written R star in the profession's notation, the interest rate the economy can bear without slowing, and is itself disinflationary, the license for patience and restraint that high rates would otherwise have to buy. Strong productivity-led growth is not something that we fear, but something we embrace. Humility over false precision, a smaller, less activist footprint, credibility and independence, rules-leaning but not mechanical, a supply-side disinflationary worldview. One program, Restoration, Not Revolution, in his own framing, and, since July 9th, five committees to carry it, due by year-end. Hold the five planks in mind. They are about to reappear, one at a time, wearing institutional clothes. Five charges. The five task forces announced on July 9th are the doctrine drawn as an organizational chart, each panel organized around one dominant plank, with the supporting planks recurring across the others. Communications, for the promises he wants stopped, will review how the Federal Reserve conveys policy deliberations and decisions amid uncertainty. Humility over false precision made institutional. Balance sheet policy, for the portfolio he wants shrunk, will examine the costs, benefits, and institutional implications of the current balance sheet regime, the smaller footprint. Data, for the gauge he distrusts, must make the Fed signals more accurate, relevant, contemporaneous, actionable. The evidence a humbler and more credible Fed would act on. Inflation frameworks, for the 2020 regime he blames, will revisit how the Federal Reserve understands and responds to the drivers of inflation, credibility, and rules without mechanics. And productivity and jobs, for the supply-side bet that must pay for all of it, will assess the economic impact of new general-purpose technologies, including artificial intelligence, to inform the Federal Reserve's policy judgments. Four of the five charges revisit complaints Warsh has pressed for a decade: the over-communication, the footprint, the slow gauge, the 2020 framework. The fifth places the wager. And the wording of the charges does quiet work. A panel charged with weighing the costs of the current regime deliberates on the chairman's ground, because whether current practice is the problem has been settled by the charge before the first meeting convenes. This, too, has a precedent in Warsh's own career. The reviewer of the Bank of England in 2014 understood that the terms of a review decide most of its findings. One coherent program, distributed across five committees. The terrain, then, belongs to the chairman. The findings belong to people. And the 15 names are where the announcement stops describing a search. The 15. Charges set the terrain. The 15 names decide what grows on it. Panel by panel, the roster reads as the doctrine pre-staffed, each directional coalition chosen for the course it had already put in print, each counterweight seated where its signature would be needed. What follows walks the five rooms. Who sits, what they have said, why the chairman wants them there, and what each panel will most probably report. Communications. Fisher, King, Fraga. The panel judging how the Fed speaks is led by the man who once operated its mouthpiece. Peter Fisher managed the New York Fed's trading desk, the room where policy meets the market, before running fixed income at BlackRock, and he delivered his verdict a decade before receiving the assignment in an address to the Shadow Open Market Committee, a standing panel of outside critics of Fed policy. As Peter R. Fisher put it, the Fed's decision-making and communications process is broken and has been for some time. It reflects badly on the Fed's credibility and legitimacy. The same address named the dot plot notorious described the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, the Fed's rate-setting body, as producing a phony consensus, and left the chair as the only member effectively accountable for the outcome. Fisher's complaint, in other words, is constitutional rather than stylistic. Anonymous projections diffuse responsibility while the real signals leak out through speeches, and that is why he holds the seat. No academic can match the operational authority of the man who ran the desk, and his address reads today as a blueprint for the reforms the chairman began in June. Mervyn King brings the opposite credential to the same conclusion. As governor of the Bank of England, he built the modern apparatus of central bank transparency, the inflation report, the fan chart, and then spent his later career warning against its excesses. Forward guidance can all too soon come to be seen as complacency, he argued in a 2021 lecture. A central bank should not be ashamed to acknowledge that it does not know where interest rates will be. His seat lets the reform be presented as a course correction by transparency's own architect, rather than a retreat into silence. Arminio Fraga is the counterweight. He built Brazil's regime on published forecasts, fan charts that draw inflation as a range of outcomes rather than a single line, and a statutory open letter for every missed target. Transparency as the source of credibility, learned in a country where credibility could not be assumed. The panel's fault line is written in its members' own careers. Fraga wants the Fed to say more, with the uncertainty stated. Fisher and King wanted to promise less. The panel's center of gravity lies with Fisher and King, with the chairman's charge behind them. Probable outcome: medium-high confidence. The dot plot scrapped or gutted, guidance downgraded, the statement made the signal, with Fraga forcing the replacement to be honest disclosure of uncertainty rather than silence. Balance sheet. Rajan, Stein, Dynan. The largest number in the review received its most carefully balanced room. The portfolio in dispute grew from roughly $800 billion in 2007 to a peak of $9 trillion in 2022, and stands near $6.7 trillion today. Run the printing press a little bit less, let the balance sheet come down, as Warsh put it in a television interview in July 2025. Raghuram Rajan, formerly governor of the Reserve Bank of India, supplies the direction of travel. As Raghuram Rajan put it, I absolutely am for shrinking the central bank balance sheet, but you want to do it carefully. His objection is mechanical, not aesthetic. Each round of bond buying leaves the banking system leaning harder on the Fed's liquidity. The cushion is converted into new short-term claims, and the abundance breeds the next fragility. He holds the seat because he is the leading academic authority on precisely the cost the charge asks the panel to weigh. A globally credentialed outsider whose peer-reviewed case supplies the evidentiary backbone a skeptical review needs. Against him sit the two most credentialed defenders the portfolio has. Jeremy Stein, a former Fed governor, is the author of the canonical case for the other side. As Jeremy Stein put it, the Federal Reserve should maintain a relatively large balance sheet, even when policy rates have moved well away from the zero lower bound. A year later, he compressed the position into four words: don't shrink the balance sheet. The position has a name: ample reserves. Keep enough central bank money in the system that banks never have to scramble for it. Beside him, Karen Dynan, a former Treasury chief economist with two decades on the Fed staff, testified to Congress in 2017 that the crisis programs produced a strong, albeit gradual, and a stronger recovery than would have occurred without accommodative monetary policy. Seating them was the price of credibility. The strongest opposing case will be argued inside the room, by its authors, and whatever survives them cannot be dismissed as an echo chamber. Probable outcome, medium confidence. Leaner, but not scarce. The mortgage bonds run off toward a treasury's only shorter book, while the ample reserves floor survives. Stein and Dynan hold the internal median on reserves, the one panel where the doctrine's own preference loses. Data. Chetty, Macmillan, Murphy.
No one on the data panel defends the status quo, because its charge is construction, not demolition. Raj Chetty of Harvard has already built the prototype. During the pandemic, his team turned anonymized card spending and payroll records into a public tracker running at a 3-day lag, a nowcast in the trades term. A reading of the economy as it stands, rather than as it stood, demonstrating that public statistics constructed from private sector data can support many research and policy analyses, providing a new tool for empirical macroeconomics. He holds the seat as the most prominent living practitioner of exactly what the charge describes. Doug Macmillan ran the largest private data machine in American retail. Walmart's shelves reported the consumer to him in real time. "The money runs out before the month is gone," he observed of his own customers in 2025, weeks ahead of any official print. His seat brings the practitioner's proof that firms can see the economy faster than the government, and the corporate relationships that could feed such a system. Kevin Murphy, of Chicago and Warsh's colleague at the Hoover Institution, is the discipline. Among the most decorated empirical economists of his generation, his career-long insistence is that no data source be trusted until its sampling frame and its denominator are known. The room's tension is speed against rigor. Chetty and Macmillan push coverage and timeliness. Murphy converts his skepticism into guardrails. And the likeliest casualty is Chetty's most expansive ambition, a statutory widening of the Fed's own data estate, trimmed back to partnerships. Probable outcome, medium-high confidence. A permanent real-time nowcast built on private data through public-private arrangements. Granular where the official series are aggregate, disciplined by Murphy's guardrails. The distrusted gauge gets its rival. Inflation frameworks. Sargent, Mankiw, White. The panel revisiting the 2020 framework, flexible average inflation targeting, FATE in the Fed's shorthand, under which past shortfalls of inflation were to be repaid with future overshoots, is anchored by the man who published its autopsy. Thomas Sargent, the Nobel laureate, reached his conclusion in 2023. As Thomas Sargent put it, this was a serious mistake, in part because it gave the Fed a reason to say the inflation emerging in the wake of the pandemic was transitory. Sargent's life's work is how expectations and policy regimes generate inflation, which makes his the most authoritative diagnosis available of the exact failure the charge names. And a shield. A framework overhaul co-signed by a Nobel laureate cannot easily be dismissed as political hawkishness. Greg Mankiw, whose textbook taught the subject to a generation, supplies the humility. The Phillips curve, the workhorse model linking unemployment to inflation, is real in theory, but not a very useful practical tool, he wrote in 2024. And the monetary aggregates deserve more attention. It is fashionable these days to ignore monetary aggregates. It may be time to rethink that position. His seat gives the rewrite its mainstream legibility. William White, formerly of the Bank for International Settlements, is the counterweight and the deepest one in the review. "The pursuit of low positive inflation itself," he wrote in 2017, "has become a dangerous delusion. His cure, watch credit and debt, tolerate more inflation, would widen the Fed's field of view, the one direction the doctrine does not travel." That is why his objection is the likeliest of the 15 to surface in print. Probable outcome, medium confidence. Fate scrapped for a symmetric 2% stated with humility. The Phillips curve demoted. The aggregates revived. White's deeper objection acknowledged and shelved. Productivity and jobs. Andreessen, Sharma, Jones. The Keystone panel is built of three optimists at different temperatures. Mark Andreessen, the venture capitalist, supplies the warmest. Every new major technology has led to more jobs at higher wages throughout history, he wrote in 2023, and claims of AI-driven displacement are 100% incorrect. He is there to voice the maximal case, and his portfolio's stake in the answer is exactly why the cooler signatures beside his will matter more. Asha Sharma, the Microsoft executive, supplies the commercial case. Software agents will outnumber employees by 2026, she forecast in a 2025 interview, drawing on deployment data across tens of thousands of firms building on the company's platforms. The widest real-time view anyone holds of how businesses actually use the technology. Charles Jones of Stanford supplies the calibration, and with it, the credibility. The leading scholar of what drives long-run growth, his own research counsels patients about the very thing he is asked to certify. General-purpose technologies take decades to reach the statistics. His function in the room is to write the optimism down at a temperature a central bank can sign. What the room does not contain, anywhere, is an opponent. It is also the panel working closest to a deadline that matters. The reports are due by year-end, and the Fed's final rate-setting meeting of the year falls in December. Probable outcome, medium-high confidence. A finding that artificial intelligence is a disinflationary supply shock raising the economy's speed limit. Hedged in scenario language, and read in December as a license for easier policy anyway. From the only panel seated without a break. 15 dots. Two patterns organize the roster. The first, the seated opponents sit where something is being torn down. The dot plot, the bond portfolio, the 2020 framework, because demolition needs their signatures for credibility. No opponent sits where something is being built. The new gauge, the supply finding, because those panels produce the deliverables the December meeting is waiting for. The second, measured against the chairman's whole program rather than any single panel's question, almost no one on the roster is an opponent at all. Of the 15, only Jeremy Stein stands in outright tension with the program itself. Warsh seated opponents of his reforms, and almost none of his program. The two patterns set up the questions that remain: what the seated opponents can and cannot do, and why the panel that licenses December is the one built without breaks. The function of a dissent. The strongest objection to everything above is sitting in the rosters. A chairman engineering conclusions would not, on the face of it, hand seats to Stein, Dynan, White, and Fraga, the four most credible opponents of the conclusions in question. Their presence is the release's best evidence for its own word, independently, and the objection deserves to be taken at full strength. Consider then what each opponent can and cannot do. Stein and Dynan hold two of three seats on the balance sheet panel. They have the standing and the memory of September 2019, when reserves ran short and overnight lending rates spiked, to block the return to a small, pre-2008 balance sheet that Warsh has publicly favoured. What they cannot do, against their own co-lead and the charge above them, is produce a report that endorses the current regime. Both are on record for gradual shrinkage of some degree. The likeliest outcome, and the one contested number in the whole review, is a portfolio that comes down without becoming scarce. The doctrine's one defeat. White can force the sharpest objection in the five panels into the record. Sargent and Mankiw still define the report's central framework. Fraga can shape what replaces the dot plot, an honest account of uncertainty rather than silence, without saving the dot plot itself. The opponents, in short, bound the reforms. They do not reverse them. And a bounded reform, signed over the recorded objection of its most credible critic, arrives at the Federal Open Market Committee carrying the one property a chairman cannot confer on his own conclusions: the appearance, and, within the bounds, the substance, of having survived resistance. The panels, on this reading, were not built to rubber stamp the doctrine. They were built to return the strongest version of it that can survive expert opposition. A narrower thing than the chairman's wish list, and a more durable one. The defeat on the balance sheet is not a flaw in the design. It is the design's proof of authenticity, purchased at the price of the one reform Warsh wanted most. Scott Clemens, chief investment strategist at Brown Brothers Harriman, compressed the arrangement into 7 words in June. Regime change, but in a velvet glove,
which leaves the panel with no glove and no fist to resist it. The one that matters most. Why it matters most, and why its deadline is December, is the business of the machinery's first application, the gauge. The machinery's first application begins with a number. Core inflation, prices with volatile food and energy stripped out, was still running near 3% when the FOMC met on June 17th. A full point above target, with the Fed's policy rate at 3.5 to 3.75%. The doctrine's endpoint, patience, restraint, and in time lower rates on the strength of supply, runs straight into that reading. Treat the gauge as a sufficient guide, the way the Fed has treated it for decades, and a near 3% print makes the cut Warsh wants difficult to justify under the inherited framework. His answer, delivered from the podium that afternoon, was to dispute the instrument rather than the reading. As Kevin Warsh put it, "I don't believe that we have a cruel choice. If we do our job, we can make strong growth, low prices, and strong employment mutually compatible. What we spend most of our time doing is counting demand. It's easier. What we do, though, is we infer supply." The distinction carries the whole argument. The gauge counts the demand side of the economy, spending, and the prices it produces. It cannot say how much the supply side is expanding beneath it, and it is supply, in the doctrine, that decides whether today's inflation persists or dissolves. A central bank that treats the counted number as its prescription will hold rates too high while a productivity boom quietly does the work. The fork this opens is the hinge of the whole design. If the gauge is a sufficient guide, the cut waits on measured inflation returning to target. If it is not, the cut requires the committee to accept a broader reading of supply, one in which rising productive capacity makes today's inflation less persistent than the gauge alone suggests. And the task forces become the machinery for changing the decision rule built around the gauge. Warsh had flagged the consequence at his confirmation hearing in April, an interest in improving the data used to measure inflation and in newer methodologies, and had already tied the repair to his review. Measuring inflation, he said, will overlap with my data group. His appointees supply the indictment's support from both ends of the measurement problem. Greg Mankiw, assigned to the inflation panel, has written that disentangling shocks to supply and demand is nearly impossible in real time. And Doug McMillan, assigned to the data panel, watched Walmart's shelves report consumer stress weeks ahead of any official print. The gauge has been contested ground before, as 2 earlier articles in this series, The Measure and The Paradox, documented. The Fed's own choice of inflation index has at times been the policy rather than the measurement of it. An inference, however, is not a license. If policy is to act on supply the Fed can only infer, some body must put the inference in writing. That is a framework problem, and Warsh solved it in June. The framework of June. A doctrine cannot outvote a gauge. What it can do is dethrone the gauge, change what the committee decides on, and that is what the June 17th meeting accomplished, as the previous article in this series, The Inference, documented. The committee held rates and changed everything around them. Forward guidance was dropped from the statement as not well suited to the current policy conjuncture. Warsh withheld his own rate projection, the refusal the first plank promised, and observed that his colleagues filled in theirs with pencils, with the big erasers. The statement itself was cut to the facts. An earlier article, The Game, had anticipated the method, a framework built instead of a coalition, and recorded the archive's caution about five prior attempts at framework-first policy.
The committee beneath the unanimous vote was split evenly. Half of my colleagues thought the policy rate should be at this level or lower between now and year-end, and the other half thought higher, Warsh told reporters. Nine members projected an increase. The disagreement was not resolved. It was scheduled. The five task forces were announced at that meeting, their reports due by year-end, and the year's final rate-setting meeting falls in December. Asked how the committee would know when expanding supply justified easier policy, Warsh answered, "We have a task force for that." The inference drew the conclusion in June. The December cut would be licensed not by the inflation data, which points the wrong way, but by a supply-side finding timed to arrive on the eve of the meeting. In June, that was an argument about machinery still unbuilt. The machinery has now been walked, room by room, which leaves only the room the finding must come from. The missing break. The productivity panel is the review's keystone, because its finding is the input the December framework is waiting for. It is also the only panel constructed without an opponent. Andreessen's optimism is doctrinal. Sharma's is commercial. Jones's is calibrated, and the calibration is the point. The one dissent the room risks runs the other way. Andreessen declining to sign a document he finds too hedged, an objection from the accelerator, not the break. Jones is a serious scholar whose own research counsels patience about the very thing he is asked to certify. His work with co-authors found that sustaining Moore's law, the steady doubling of computing power, now requires more than 18 times the researchers it took in the early 1970s, and that general-purpose technologies historically take decades to surface in productivity statistics. Nothing measurable between July and December can establish that artificial intelligence has raised the economy's speed limit. The panel can assemble adoption figures, the $254 billion of AI infrastructure spending in 2025 is counted demand, visible in any national account. But the supply-side payoff it is charged to assess will still be an inference. The Fed has faced this exact question before and answered it differently. In the late 1990s, as the inference set out, the supply-side minority, Robert McTeer of the Dallas Fed most prominently, argued that the technology boom was disinflationary and prevailed only as years of data accumulated. Alan Greenspan conceded at a 2000 meeting that his staff had been continuously forecasting decline in multi-factor productivity growth. That slowdown hasn't happened. The vindication was earned at the pace of the evidence. The current version is scheduled. The report is due by year-end, and the year's last meeting is in December. A finding produced by three optimists on a deadline, however carefully Jones hedges its language, will function as what the framework requires it to be: a license. That is the whole of the mechanism, assembled. A five-plank doctrine, five charges on the doctrine's ground. Directional coalitions that set their courses in print years ago, constraints positioned where credibility is needed and none where the deliverable is made, and a framework that dethrones the gauge and waits, in December, for the deliverable. Checkable by New Year.
The reading above is falsifiable and on a short clock. If it is right, the communications report will retire or gut the dot plot, downgrade guidance, and move the burden of signalling to the statement itself, with Fraga's hand visible in whatever replaces the projections, or in a published objection. The balance sheet report will recommend further shrinkage, running the mortgage bonds off toward a Treasuries-only, shorter book,
but stop short of the scarce reserves regime Warsh has favoured, Stein and Dynan's boundary holding. The data report will stand a real-time gauge, built on private data, beside the official statistics rather than in place of them. The inflation report will scrap fate for a symmetric 2% stated with humility, demote the Phillips curve, revive the monetary aggregates, and acknowledge White's financial cycle critique without adopting it, White being the likeliest of the 15 to dissent in print. The productivity report will hedge its evidence in scenario language, decline to claim a measured boom, and be cited in December all the same as grounds for the cut. And the committee that split evenly in June will deliver that cut at the December meeting. The predictions are not equally firm. The deaths of the dot plot and of fate are the firmest, because no one in either room defends them. The contests there are over what replaces them. The balance sheet boundary rests on a divided room whose internal median sits with the defenders of ample reserves. And the December cut, hostage to a committee that divided evenly in June, is the least certain of the chain and the most consequential. A documented stance and influence audit. Every member scored on their panel's contested question, every room averaged with the chairman's pull included, produces the same rankings and the same order of confidence. The full tables are published with the written article. Each prediction can fail, and any failure would count against the argument. If a panel surprises its charge, if the balance sheet report demands scarcity, if the productivity panel declines to certify, if December passes without the cut, this reading was wrong, and the next post will say so. The record of Framework First projects cautions in both directions. As the game documented from five historical precedents, conclusions installed ahead of their evidence have tended to end badly for the institutions that installed them. A warning that applies to the doctrine and equally to any confident reading of it, including this one. The slate. A slate is a list of names put forward together. It is also a thing already settled, slated, scheduled, set down in advance. Both senses were present in the July 9th announcement, and the 15 biographies say which governs. The direction was decided on the day the membership was. The boundaries were delegated to the people inside the room. Each panel will return a finding whose course its coalition put in print years before it was asked, and whose limits its counterweight will have drawn. The dot plot gone, the portfolio leaner but not scarce, a faster gauge beside the official one, fate dead with 2% kept, and, from the only panel seated without an opponent, the productivity finding that arrives by year-end as the license for the December cut. The review will not have discovered the direction. It will have hardened it. What July 9th announced as a search, 15 independent experts, a mandate to follow the evidence, was the doctrine coming back as findings. The coalitions supply the direction. The counterweights supply the credibility and the limits. The charges supply the ground. The evidentiary lens was chosen when the names were. Whether every seat was calculated to that end, or the end simply found congenial names, the record cannot show, and the mechanism does not require. The structure performs the same office either way, returning not a rubber stamp, but the strongest version of the doctrine that can survive its own critics. Warsh calls the program restoration rather than revolution, and the word is apt. A restoration returns an institution to a form someone has already decided upon. And December, for all the machinery pointed at it, is only that machinery's first scheduled use. A rate cut is transient, a rebuilt way of speaking, of measuring, of holding. The doctrine-made procedure outlasts any single meeting. 15 years separate the doctrine from the roster. The reports are due by December. What happens at that meeting was the subject of the previous article, and who was chosen to make it happen has now been the subject of this one. Collapse the five probable reports into what recurs across them, and the residue is the doctrine itself. Humility over false precision, the smaller footprint, credibility and independence, rules short of mechanics, the supply-side worldview, the planks returned as findings. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.